Now, we were speaking last time about F, the rise of Darwinism. And under that, we looked at number four, the origin of the origin of species, and we're just starting to speak about number five, Thomas Henry Huxley. Did I say William? I should have said Thomas before. Thomas Henry Huxley, T.H. Huxley. He is the man we refer to as Huxley. His son did some writing, and so you'll occasionally see references to him. His grandsons have done a great deal of writing, and you'll see references to them. One of them died just a few years ago. Other, I think Sir Julian Huxley is still living, and although retired now, I believe. He was head of UNESCO for a number of years. But when we simply say Huxley, we're apt to mean the man who made the name famous, Thomas Henry Huxley. I did not mention to you the fact that Thomas Henry Huxley, in his early life, went on a long exploring trip somewhat as Darwin had, but not as an explorer as Darwin had. Darwin had gone as the natural. Huxley went on a boat called the Rattlesnake, and he went on this as a doctor, or a surgeon they might have called him. He was trained in medicine. He went as the doctor of the trip, but he was much interested in what he observed in the trip. He later became professor of anatomy. He was a careful scientific investigator and a man of real standing in science. He was also a very excellent speaker, an outstanding debater, a man who just loved a debate or a controversy of any kind, and who could always find all the good arguments and think of others if he didn't know good ones. He was a very effective debater, and he used to give lectures to working men on science. He gave lectures to all kinds of people, which he was quite good in adapting to the particular background of the group to whom he spoke, and he was a very effective man for general contact with people, and at the same time, a good, solid scientist. No question of that. He was a very different type, you see, from Darwin. We noticed his attitude towards religion, how, as a young man, he turned violently against the church. He disliked the church, he disliked the bishop. He was quite sure that in his early days he used to attack the Bible. He had a long controversy in his middle life with Gladstone. He said that to say that Christ was good was foolish, because after all, Christ told the demons that came out of the man to go into the swine, and that was a destruction of property. There was no reason for it at all. The swine ran down into the sea and was drowned, and he used it as impugning the ethics of Christ and the ethics of the Bible. He did quite a bit of this in his middle life, in his controversies with Gladstone, so on. We noticed his early attitude towards fixity of species. He took over Linnaeus's early idea. He had no question about it. Darwin tried to convince him that species weren't so fixed. There might be a development of one out of another. Huxley was unconvinced. He was a good friend of a man named Herbert Spencer, a man who could write books on any subject, whether he knew anything about them or not. He had a very vivid mind, quick logic, and he was a very great hater of Christianity, Herbert Spencer. He was teaching evolution in his book long before The Origin of Species was issued. Gertrude Himmelfarb, in her book on Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution, speaks very scathingly in some ways of Spencer's, what he said, talking about a thing, whether he knew anything about it or not. And yet, we must not belittle him beyond what he should be, because he did have a very keen mind, and he was quick to put things together and to construct theories and to present them in an able way. And his book had a very great influence. He was a good friend of Huxley's, and he was teaching evolution for years. But Huxley could not agree with Spencer on this and argued strongly against it with him. We noticed that Darwin was wondering, as he sent advanced copies of his book to many friends, he said to some of them, "I wonder what Huxley's going to say about it." Huxley was quite a little younger than Darwin, but Darwin had considerable regard for Huxley's mind, and he's never been able to convince Huxley. And so he wondered what Huxley's attitude would be. But Huxley began to hear something of the attack which religious people were making against his ideas and against Darwin. And he wrote Darwin a letter thanking him for the book, and he said was not yet ready to express a judgment on the book, but he spoke strongly in this way. He said, "This book is going to arouse a great attack upon you. You can be sure of that." And he said, "As your friend, I'm going to come to your defense." He said, "I'm already sharpening my beak for the attack." And he promised to defend Darwin. Later he said that when he saw the book, he read parts of the manuscript without being convinced, but when he saw the whole book together in one form, printed, this is past the publication, and pre-publication copy, he then said, was convinced that Darwin was right. Through a rather accidental circumstance, we noticed one of the great newspapers asked him to write the review for it. And in his review, he spoke very strongly in support of the book and of Darwin's theory. Although Huxley never adopted this theory 100%. Huxley said some years later, he said, "I've just reread The Origin of Species for the sixth time." He said, "It is a very difficult book to fully understand." And he maintained certain doubts as to whether Darwin's principle really was the determining factor in evolution of species. Though he said, "We must always be grateful to Darwin for what he did in destroying this idea of direct creation of species." Well, Huxley was very active in many regards, but the first time he came into real prominence, because I believe the review was anonymous in the newspaper, the first time he came into real prominence in this connection was a few months after The Origin of Species was issued, when there was a meeting of the British Association of Science in Oxford. It was an annual meeting which was held there every year. And among the discussions, subject for discussion, one of the most prominent was the discussion of the origin of species. Darwin did not go. Darwin practically never went to meet. Darwin was in bad health, as you know. He was sick most of the time, so he kept at his work a few hours every day, and he pushed ahead. And he never allowed himself to be diverted from it, practically never to go anywhere. And he had to, later on, he was given all kinds of medals and prizes and honors. He nearly always sent Huxley to represent him, and practically never himself went. So Darwin was not present at the meeting, but Huxley was there. And the two of them made a marvelous combination for the advancement of the theory. Because Darwin was there in the background, not a man whom you saw personally much, not a man who engaged in direct acrimonious discussion. Occasionally he did in writing, but not in face-to-face contact. He hated that sort of thing. He would have kept away from it if at all possible. But he was considered as the man of careful, methodical study, who was sitting in his study there and working on these scientific matters. Before that, they had had evolution presented anonymously in the Vestiges of Creation. It had been widely discussed, but was not, Huxley had written a most scathing review of, was not considered to be a thoroughly scientific book, and nobody knew who the author was anyway. Lamarck, the Frenchman, had presented evolution strongly, and there were, Spencer was following Lamarck's theory, but there was no outstanding scientist supporting such an idea. And most of the scientists were against it. Now here was a man considered as a careful, methodical student, a man who was simply a great scientist, who spent 10 years studying barnacles, worked in the little details. That was the type of man, not a controversialist. And here is his book presenting the theory. It gave respectability to the theory. It gave standing to it. It made it seem to be not the offhand idea of some debater, some promoter, but the work of a careful scholar who, as a result of a great amount of study, had reached a conclusion. Actually, of course, if you notice, that was not the case. Darwin had rather suddenly thought of his idea as a result of reading Malthus' book on population and Wallace thought exactly the same idea. Darwin said you'd think it was exactly what I'd written. Darwin got it from reading Malthus the same way. He put the two things together and got the same idea. And in fact, the theory that Darwin presented was already contained in some books that had appeared before, though not quite as directly presented as Darwin presented. The phrase, survival of the fittest, was a phrase which Spencer had already used in his writing. But Darwin was there as the man who was not in the heat of controversy, not a man subject to attack and reply. That is, he did occasionally, but not often, and simply in writing when he did. But Huxley was the one who was out presenting the matter, arguing, debating, attacking, and he could point to Darwin as the great source of the theory. Well, now, Huxley was comparatively little known in this regard as yet when this meeting occurred, a few months after the issuance of the book. And an incident occurred there which, in my opinion, brought into sharp focus the real situation, the fact that it was the result of the Victorian era, that is, the result of the evangelical revival which produced what they called the Victorian era, when there was this idea of duty, this idea of high morality, this idea of seeking truth for its own sake. This idea, and then there were those who had positions in the church and wanted to support them, and some of whom had receded quite a bit from the that which is the source of the ethics and of the attitude toward truth. Now, this meeting at Oxford lasted several days. Huxley was present one day, and different ones gave papers on different theological matters, and there were some references to Darwin, different scientific matters. I mean, there were references to Darwin. There was the third day, there was to be some more discussion on this, and a man who was expected to speak was the Bishop of Liverpool, Samuel Wilberforce, a man of very considerable ability, but who had spread his ability over many different fields. He was an able speaker, and he could say very strong things in a very pleasant way, so that nobody got offended except the one he was directly attacking. And some people called him Soapy Sam. That was the nickname which many gave to him, many of those who did not like him, but many regarded him very highly. And Wilberforce was to speak on the third day among the various speakers, and Huxley decided he'd had enough, thought he'd leave. And he met Chambers on the street, who was the author of the book, The Vestiges of Creation, so Huxley didn't know it yet. Chambers knew that Huxley had written this terrible blast against his book a few years before. But he knew now that Huxley was defending Darwin, and he was sympathetic. And he said to Huxley, well, he said, are you looking forward to the meeting tomorrow? No, Huxley said, I think I'm going to leave. He said, I don't feel much inclination to be ecclesiastically pounded. And Chambers said, oh, he said, I think it's your duty to stay. He said, somebody should be there that has a good scientific knowledge of these matters to answer what Soapy Sam may say against Darwin. And so he persuaded Huxley to stay. Well, Huxley was one of the group sitting on the platform when Wilberforce spoke. Owen, one of the leading scientists of the day, a man who was very much a rival of Darwin and who was very strongly opposed to the whole evolutionary matter, had been consulted by Wilberforce, and Wilberforce had gathered considerable amount of information from him, probably too much. That is, he got so much scientific information that he didn't get it all accurate and clear in its interrelation. And the result was that when Wilberforce presented it, he got some things twisted, and some things presented in an erroneous way. And Huxley said, when he heard him say some remarks the first day of the meeting, he said, Wilberforce doesn't have near the knowledge I thought he had in these areas. Well, Wilberforce spoke presenting various evidences and getting into the field of anatomy, which, of course, was where Huxley was particularly at home, being professor of anatomy. And then Wilberforce went into rather personal attacks upon Darwin and those who were holding this evolutionary view, dealing in sarcastic sort of argument, so given in such a tone that it didn't give that impression, except the people directly involved, who had irritated tremendously. And then he turned toward Huxley on the platform, and he said, I hope when Mr. Huxley speaks that he will tell us whether it's through his grandfather or his grandmother that he's descended from a monkey. And when he said that, Huxley brought his hand down like this on the knee of the man next to us, who looked up and was startled, and Huxley said, the Lord has delivered it into my hand. Quoting the Bible statement, even though Huxley didn't believe from the Lord, he quoted the statement, and this man was startled and wondered what on earth Huxley was talking about. Well, after Wilberforce spoke, then one or two others spoke, and then they called for Huxley. And Huxley was very able in handling himself. He stepped forward almost apologetically, said that there were a few things about the Bishop of Wilberforce. Bishop's remark that he thought needed a little correction. And then he brought out a few little anatomical things where his statements had been slightly inaccurate and corrected them and then attacked his main thesis from the viewpoint of scientific attacks on evolution and so on. He went at this and gradually got a little further into it and a little further into it, a little more heated as he spoke. And then he says, but now he says, as to the question about my ancestors, he said, I must say that I would far rather be descended from a simple creature that can walk upright and climb about trees and can handle himself to the, as well as with his limited understanding he can do it and it's no harm to anybody, than to be descended from a man who with great abilities prostitutes those abilities by talking about things he knows nothing about and attacking scientific fields in which he's utterly incompetent to enter. Now, I don't recall the exact words, but nobody did. It's different. The words are given different ways in three or four different books. But that's approximately what he said. But people weren't used to hearing the bishop attacked in this way, and they say the students threw their hats in the air, one woman fainted. There was tremendous excitement when he made these remarks, and some discussions of it speak as if that was the turning point in the whole debate. I don't think it was in itself the turning point, but it certainly represents what happened. Because here you had those who were advancing the evolutionary theory appearing before the world as the men who were seeking truth for its own sake, who weren't excited about whether they were descended from monkeys or who they were descended from. There isn't one of us here who could name those of his ancestors, all of his ancestors who lived 300 years ago. There isn't a person here who could probably name a fifth of those of his ancestors who were living 300 years ago. We don't know anything about our ancestors. Anyway. But they were not interested in these things of emotion. They were interested in truth. That's the point. The impression of it. Whereas, on the other hand, you had Wilberforce with his sarcastic attack, which was easily seen to be a trying to step aside from the real question and appeal to emotion. And thus, you have the force of the background of the evangelical revival, which raised these great feelings of ethics, of duty, of desire to seek truth, wherever you find it, and made them so widespread in them at that time. You have this used to destroy the very thing that the evangelical revival stood for, the integrity of the Bible and the belief in God. And this is what really happened and made the tremendous change. Now, of course, Huxley went out and carried on his great campaigns in writing, speaking here and there, in supporting Darwin right down the line. The matters that Huxley had questions about, and he simply kept quiet about it. But there were plenty of points where it was attacked, where he could, with full determination, make a very strong stand. And eventually, Huxley became, he became so famous that when he came to America, there were thousands came to hear him in New York. The papers had big headlines about his arrival in New York, which was just about 20 years later. Huxley got a tremendous reputation and standing, but he was always not presenting himself. He was presenting Darwin, presenting Darwin's ideas. And there was Darwin, this great, quiet scholar, slowly, carefully considering and bringing out the truth as against the old-fashioned superstitious ideas of people who believed in the Bible. And so within 10 years, that change took place in Oxford, or in England, that was almost inconceivable. The most of the scientists were against Darwin's theory when they were presented. And most of the older scientists never did accept his theory. But the younger scientists adopted that. They were adopted in the schools, they were adopted in the propaganda, in the teaching, in the attitude. The, in fact, 10 years after this meeting at Oxford, one of Darwin's close friends was elected president of the British Association, and in his inaugural address, he described this meeting 10 years before as if it had been a meeting led by superstitious savages to whom some missionaries had come with the real truth and with great effort had succeeded in getting it through to them. There was no opposition to it. Huxley came to begin to feel, my things are moving too fast. And he wrote to Darwin, he says, your theories are coming to be universally accepted. He says, I think it'll soon be time for me to go into opposition. He loved the controversy. He loved an attack. And toward the end of his life, it is very interesting that Huxley disappointed some of his friends greatly. Huxley was appointed on a commission to give a report on the conditions of British education. And Huxley reported that he felt that it was very vital that the Bible be kept at the center of British education. He said, how can we expect to maintain high ethics, to maintain high morality among our people, if the Bible, which is to so great an extent a source of peace, is not kept at its central place in English education? Of course, along with it, he made a few blurs as to the factual nature of the Bible. He was thinking of it more as a means to produce a result. But it's interesting that he felt that for that result, he saw what so many others didn't see, that the ethics which they took for granted as simply something that any gentleman will hold is not something that is natural to humanity, but that it comes as a result of training and of background. And he saw how great a part the Bible had played in that. And then toward the end of his life, he began to see many people advancing the idea that the survival of the fittest is the way that evolution moves forward, and therefore the way for humanity to move forward is simply by the destruction of the weak and the pushing forward of the strong and so on. And so Huxley began to attack those ideas, and he attacked not only the Christian attitudes, but also the new attitudes that were coming in these questions. He said, I know no study which is so unutterably saddening as that of the evolution of humanity. And he went on to indict mankind for bearing the mark of the beast. He said, his slow rise was attended by infinite weakness, bloodshed, and misery. And in 1893, he gave a lecture. There was, they called the Romanus Lectures on Ethics, and he spoke on evolution and ethics. And in this lecture, he said, we must not let the evolutionary idea be central in our ethics. He said, if there's a generalization from the fact of human life, which has the assent of thoughtful men in every age and country, it is that the violator of ethical rules constantly escapes the punishment which he deserves. That the wicked flourishes like a green bay tree while the righteous begs his bread. That the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children. That in the realm of nature, ignorance is punished just as severely as willful wrong, and that thousands upon thousands of innocent beings suffer for the crime or the unintentional trespass of one. He said social progress means a checking of the cosmic process at every step, and the substitution for it of another which may be called the ethical process, the end of which is not the survival of those who may happen to be the fittest, but of those who are ethically the best. The ethical progress of society depends not on imitating the cosmic process, still less in running away from it, but in combating it. Now, this lecture discusses most of his friends, his evolutionary friends. There are a number of lives of Huxley that have been published, and most of them praise him for his great abilities and his great controversy, his great effectiveness in so many ways. I was much interested to read one of them, which, after going through and praising him pretty much right through almost to the last page, in the last page says, but there were those in Huxley's day, he said, that if his ideas were effective, the result would be a lowering of ethical standards and moral standards, and would be a loss of those qualities which were so highly regarded by him and his associates in the Victorian age. And the book said on the last page, it says, the events have proven this to be the case. He said, just look at his two grandsons and look at Aldous Huxley with his licentious novels that he has written, and look at Julian Huxley with his new evolutionary religion that he's tried to advance. And it was interesting how this book, after praising him through maybe 400 pages, ended with a page in which it spoke of the effects of his teaching as being so different from what Huxley himself ever would have desired. Well, Huxley had this great influence in England, and there was another man somewhat similar to him who had a similar influence in Germany named Ernst Haeckel, H-A-E-C-K-E-L. Ernst Haeckel was a man who in early life had turned violently against Christianity. He was a man of good scientific ability who in his early life did research in biology, which was highly regarded. The books that speak of Haeckel usually say most of his good scientific work was done in his early days. Because Haeckel, even more than Huxley, became so taken up with this matter that he put the controversy for the advancement of evolution as primary in his activity. Haeckel came over to England and saw Darwin, talked with him. He translated the Origin of Species into German. And he devoted the rest of his life to presenting these ideas and arguing for them in Germany. And he went to a very great extent in his attack on everything that would believe in God, that would believe in a central religious teaching in this universe. And one writer says that it is interesting how, as things work out, people admired Darwin, and all of their antagonism came against Haeckel. And isn't it awful, these attitudes Haeckel is taking? But look at that great English scientist, Darwin, and how wonderful he is. And so Haeckel, like Huxley, succeeded in advancing evolution in his country to a very great extent. Later writers say that at point Haeckel twisted the scientific evidence intentionally in some ways in order to make the argument for evolution look better. He was the originator of what is called the biogenetic law, the law that in the development of the embryo, the history of the race is recapitulated. Haeckel invented that as an argument for evolution. He called it a law, and it was a few years ago taught as one of the primary evidences for evolution. Today, Most investigators in the field recognize that it takes a very large extent in this proof that there is no such recapitulation as Haeckel maintains. We'll say a few words about that in another connection a little later. Number six, the sweeping victory of Darwin. The sweeping victory of Darwin. It was on the face of it, there was a tremendous change. A change which took place, as we noticed, right in one decade. In 1860, most of the scientists were against evolution. Most of the church leaders were against it. In fact, most of them were bitterly opposed to it. 10 years later, the scientific organizations were praising Darwin, speaking highly of evolution, and many of the church leaders were accepting and maintaining that it was entirely consistent with Christian viewpoint. What were the causes of this great change? Let's just summarize them quickly. Let's mention, number one, the decline of the force of the evangelical revival. Now, we've had these declines all through history. We have a tremendous forward surge of Christian people. A tremendous forward surge. A great influence. A whole nation affected, not all saved by any means, but the nation in its viewpoint affected tremendously. Ethics and morality greatly elevated. We have a tremendous influence. It lasts a century or two. And then we have a decline. People lose their enthusiasm, lose their interest. People get into positions who are interested only in holding a position and are thus maintain doctrines simply because they're supposed to rather than because they really believe them. Decline sets in. This decline was well underway by the time of the issuance of the Origin of Species. Spencer, Chambers, many others were writing evolutionary ideas and anti-Christian ideas, but their influence was comparatively small. It was a large number, but out of the whole, a very small group of educated people holding it. And the apparent sweeping change was not so sweeping as it seemed because it had been being prepared for quite a time. But the great difference between this and the decline of all previous great evangelical movements was that in connection with the decline, there came a carefully worked out teaching that knocked at the basis, hit at the foundation of Christian belief, and that this came to become established in a position where it could affect the ideas of succeeding generations to a very great extent. Now, of course, the evolution was only one part of that thing, but it is a very vital part, and it had many consequences. Darwin didn't particularly see these consequences. He was quite single-eyed in his interest in his scientific work, so he was very definitely anti-Christian in his viewpoint all through his life. Occasionally, you often hear the story that somebody went to Darwin toward the end of his life, and Darwin told him how he regretted the harm he had done to Christianity, and some people even think Darwin was converted at the end of his life. There's absolutely no truth to it. Darwin was very gracious, and he would agree with most anybody who had them get into any argument. And if you said, what a shame your ideas have done so much harm, he'd say, oh, I'm so sorry if they've done any harm. If they have been injurious, I regret it. He was very kindly and very, well, I don't even call it kindly or shy, but at least he didn't want to disagree with people to their face much. You'll hear those stories, but they are quite without foundation. But this was not an active part of his teaching or his activity. He was concentrating on his scientific work, which interested him primarily and tremendously. But others seized a hold and got something established which had a continuing influence and a tremendous influence and has to this day. Now, number two, I think some something that greatly advanced the ability of the evolutionary attitude to take the whole was the substitution by Christians of Linnaeus' science for biblical exegesis. Linnaeus said, every species is separate and distinct. God made them this way. And Christians took this over from Linnaeus, not from the Bible. The Bible says God created kinds. It doesn't say how big the kinds are. It doesn't say that God, it doesn't say how many kinds he created. Did he create 10 kinds? Did he create 50 kinds? Did he create 1,000 kinds? Did he create 1,000,000 kinds? The Bible doesn't say. And when we read something into the Bible that is not specifically taught there, we put ourselves in a position where if we read something into it that is not true, or at least that can be made to appear to be untrue, we put ourselves in a very weak position. And so this idea of Linnaeus, which Linnaeus himself moved away from toward the latter part of his life, this idea became established among scientists and among Christians as a whole. And so it was to some extent a conflict between the science of one generation and that of another, rather than a conflict between science and religion. And you take the idea here, these million species, everyone's absolutely, God created every one of them separate. And then you say, oh no, look, there's good reason to think that this one may have developed out of this one. There's good reason to think that. Well, all right, give up the whole idea they all developed this way in natural process. It's jumping from one extreme to the other. And very often, on any point, when we go to an extreme that goes beyond what the Bible specifically presents, we get into a position which makes it easy for a movement that will sweep to the other extreme event. I feel that in our own day, there is a great danger among evangelicals of doing exactly the same thing in this regard in relation to the question of the days of creation. I've heard people say, I believe in 6 literal days. Well, what is a literal day? What is a literal day? That's not the question. The question is, what does the Bible mean when it says that in the one day God did this, in the second day he did this, in the third day he did this? What does it mean by a day? I saw a debate in which Harry Rimmer very strongly argued for what he called 24-hour days. He said there's no question what a day is. A day represents a sidereal revolution of the earth. That is a day. Now he said even if there's no sun, even if there's no light, that is what a day is. Well, actually, I don't believe, aside from some work in astronomy, I don't think there's anybody here who would once in 10 years use the word day meaning a sidereal revolution of the earth. Because there are 366 1/4 sidereal revolutions of the earth on its axis in a year. But the days that we talk about, there's only 365 1/4. So we never refer to a sidereal revolution of the earth on its axis as a day in ordinary speech. Now it may be done in astronomy, which is quite reasonable. I don't know whether it is or not. But I know we do not in ordinary speech. A day in the scripture means a period of activity. And normally it's a period of light between 2 periods of darkness. So that at the North Pole it'd be about 6 months long. And a day is, in the north of Scotland, is about 6 or 7 hours long in winter, and about 23 hours long in summer. A day is normally the period of activity between 2 periods of rest. That's the way we use it for ordinary. If I meet at 11 tonight and I say, isn't this a lovely day? You say, what are you talking about? This isn't day, this is night. The use of the word day for a 24-hour period is almost entirely restricted to figuring interest and dealing with railway timetables. We don't use it in that sense. A day, I heard a man on the radio the other day, and he said, back in Lincoln's day, people felt so-and-so. What day did he mean by Lincoln's day? We use the term day frequently for a period of activity is a day. So the most common period of activity is the light between 2 periods of darkness. Now when it says in Genesis that God created the earth and did so much in one day, so much in another day. If you want to think that day was 6 minutes long, or 6 hours long, or 24 hours long, or 10,000 years long, you are not different from the Bible with any one of these, because the Bible doesn't say how long the day is. But when we insist on something that the Scripture does not teach, we are making it easy for people to be carried to another extreme. And I think that's what happened about Linnaeus' theory of the species. There's great divergence of opinion today as to what a species is. Much discussion to try to get the satisfactory definition of a species. Some that were thought to be one species a few years ago are today divided into several by scientists, and some that were several are now considered one. Just what the kinds are, we don't know, but we know there were kinds and God created them. And what development may have occurred, the Bible does not say. But the evolutionary idea is that all things developed by natural causes from one simple star is simply without biblical foundation. Now, number three, as an important cause, is certainly the activity of Huxley and Haeckel. The activity of these two men was tremendously effective in establishing the evolutionary theory. And Darwin was important as the flag that could point to, the emblem, the symbol of this being a grave, scientific, careful, methodical thing, rather than simply somebody's idea, like Spencer's theory, for instance. Now, that was the sixth, was the sweeping victory of Darwinism. I want to mention a certain consideration. Number seven, some considerations regarding evolution. We can't take much time on this, but I want to say a few words on some of them. Small a, evolution is not really science, but history. Not really science, but history. That is to say, it is a theory that all things have developed by natural causes from one simple start. Well, now that is a question of what has happened in the past. It is a question of history. And when you have a matter in history, you are interested in evidence for it of a historical type rather than of a scientific type. Science, a scientific type of evidence may show something is happening today. If you show that something is happening today, you have a certain warrant for suggesting what may have happened in the past. It doesn't prove necessarily what did happen. So, of course, the more definite evidence you have as to what is happening now, the stronger your basis for suggesting what probably would have happened in the past. But history normally requires eyewitness evidence. And there is no eyewitness evidence for the development of all types of life from one simple source. There is no eyewitness evidence for the beginning of any one of the major classes of life, either of plants or of animals. There's no eyewitness evidence in the past for the development of any species out of another species. There is no eyewitness evidence for the development of any new species today under natural conditions. There is alleged evidence for the development, in two or three cases, I believe at most, for the development of new species today under laboratory conditions. That is, under conditions of selection, crossbreeding, other ways in which man is directing it. There is the claim that there have been certain new species established. But in most, perhaps all of these cases, there would be many scientists who would question whether a new species really had been established and not merely a variety. So eyewitness evidence, the type that history requires, is lacking for evolutionary events in the past. And as for alleged eyewitness evidence for evolution in the present, it is practically nil. So that evolution is really a guess that, and a negative guess at that, because it is a guess that God never created any distinct species or genus or family or class, any direct type of life. It is a negative claim which is not based on the type of evidence we need for a historical matter such as this is. I have an interesting book here, The International Series of Monographs on Pure and Applied Biology. This book is called The Implications of Evolution by G.A. Kerkut, M.A., Ph.D., Department of Physiology and Biochemistry, University of Los Angeles. And Kerkut, who is, I believe, an evolutionist, at least he does not deny evolution, and he holds to certain phases of it at least, in his introduction here, he discusses the state of British education, and he points out how until 1871, in order to be on the faculty of Cambridge, you had to be ordained. And until near the end of the last century, you had to be a member in good standing of the Church of England to even be a student in either Oxford or Cambridge. And he points out how the hold of the church on the university was so very strong, and when things came to the point where people had comparatively little belief in it, they still had to go through the form of this in order to satisfy the examiners to have a position in the university. Now, he says, a change has come. Instead of the church having its hold, there is a different sort of a hold which is very similar, because he says it makes a certain general attitude of acceptance without proof of a certain viewpoint. And I see it's 2 of them. I don't want you to be late to chapel, so we'll go into that a little more.